World News Today, brought to you by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. By shortwave broadcast, direct from important overseas stations, as well as leading news centers of our own country, CBS correspondents are waiting to bring you a complete report from the world's political and battlefronts. But first, here's Doug Edwards.
The Allied Fifth Army is forcing the Germans back from nearly all their positions on the Volturno River in Italy today, while the British Eighth continues to advance along its front. Berlin admits the Germans have given up hopes of holding the Dnieper River line, and Moscow reports continued heavy fighting at Melitopol. The Yugoslav partisans announce a new victory for their forces in the Balkans, and there are reports of patriot uprisings in France. In the Pacific, General MacArthur's troops on New Guinea have advanced to within 40 miles of the Jap base at Madang. Now, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Algiers, Winston Burdett reporting.
The Battle of the Volturno is being fought out today along a 22-mile front from the Tyrrhenian Sea to the foothills of the Apennines. Two solid Allied bridgeheads, one held by the British on the flat land by the sea, the other seized by the Americans in the hills northeast of Capua, have forced the Germans to abandon most of their original positions on the north bank of the Volturno River. In a dispatch sent yesterday, CBS correspondent Farnsworth Farrell, who is with the Americans near Capua, tells how our foothold beyond the Volturno has been steadily expanded. Until now, we control the whole steep ridge running north on the further side. From both banks of the Volturno, he says, and along the slopes of that ridge, great clouds of white vapor were billowing up yesterday morning. It was a screen to protect a fresh battalion of Americans that was going across. It kept a lot of guns busy firing smoke shells, which explode with a great red flash and then roll up like summer clouds. The new battalion, Powell says, got onto the ridge early in the morning. They were pushing northward along it all day. The Germans were retreating, but dropping a mess of mortar bombs as they went. Above the German rear guard, one of our artillery observation planes wheeled like a hawk. That cramped the mortar's style, because it's pretty dangerous for the Germans to give away their positions when there are a couple of hundred guns the other side of the river just begging for targets. In this American sector, Fowler reports, the river crossings and the gaining of the protected ring of hills beyond has been right on schedule from the very start. The forces further down the river ran into tougher opposition. But up in the hills, too, American infantry had to battle with rifles, grenades, and light mortars before the Germans gave up or gave up. One American battalion took 10% casualties, mostly wounded. The proportion of killed was comparatively low. East of the Volturno front, our troops have made some fresh gains, which may affect the course of battle down in the plain. But wherever we have really begun to threaten their flank, the Germans have begun to fight back harder. Further east still, patrols of the 8th Army are pushing westward. The whole of the important lateral road, which runs down from Termoli on the Adriatic coast to Vincia Toro in the middle of the Apennines, is now in British hands. Theoretically, the 8th's advance across the mountains constitutes another threat to the Germans north of the Volturno. But it is still a long-distance threat. Montgomery's men have another 35 or 40 miles to go before they are within striking distance of the western plain. With the Germans resisting the way they are, the signs are that the Battle of the Volturno will go on for several days before the decision is reached. I return you now to CBS in New York.
More news in just a moment. But first, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
The Admiral Radio in your home is an important part of your daily life, as an instrument of entertainment and in bringing you the news of the world, as does this Admiral program. But to three boys afloat on an icebox door off the coast of Italy, radio, perhaps an Admiral-built radio, meant the difference between life and death. An Allied patrol chaser had just completed a Mediterranean run and was returning to its home base. Suddenly, without warning, a lurking U-boat struck. There was a terrific explosion as a torpedo ripped into the stern. So quickly did the craft sink that there was hardly time to release the life rafts, and three of the crew could find only the door of an icebox blown out of the galley by the explosion to keep them afloat. For 14 hours they clung to their frail support, watching swarms of bombers shuttle past overhead, hoping one of these planes would see them. One did see them. And from the plane's radio, there flashed a message to the home base, summoning a ship to the rescue. Admiral equipment is serving on many fighting fronts, in guiding our ships, planes, and tanks to the attack, in summoning aid to our men in distress, and in many other ways. In peacetime, the world's largest manufacturer of radio phonograph combinations with automatic record changers, Admiral is today planning for conversion to civilian service, to the building of the new Admiral, America's smart set. Now, here once again is Doug Edwards.
In this country, the latest coal strike appears to have ended, and Congress is getting ready for more work on wartime problems. For this news, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Washington, Robert Lewis reporting.
Washington, as it's done several times previously this year, is keeping an anxious watch in the nation's coal fields. There, some 25,000 miners have been ordered back to the pits. The War Labor Board's order, issued yesterday, used the term immediately. But John L. Lewis's appeal was for tomorrow morning, taking into consideration the customary Sunday layoff. And that's expected to be the time when they'll return. If they don't, it'll mean, perhaps, another general walkout. What would happen then is anyone's guess, and there seems to be no one here who's willing to hazard an opinion about what could be done either under the Anti-Strike Act or other means to get the miners to return. But there does seem to be a feeling here that Lewis's request might be honored. The next step, then, will come when the War Labor Board acts on the contract already negotiated by the Illinois operators and the union. Lewis says that it probably will be approved. If it is, then, in turn, it's expected to serve as a yardstick for other contract with eastern operators. Two other labor problems also are in the news. The operating railroad brotherhoods have termed their wage increase of 4 cents an hour, granted by economic stabilizer Vinson, an insult. They had asked for considerably more, and they're meeting in Chicago on Friday to decide whether or not to take a strike vote. The non-operating employees meet here in Washington tomorrow. They will be face-to-face with another emergency commission set up by the president to study their wage demands. But they have the president's promise for a decision by the middle of November. On the congressional scene, new developments in both the tax and post-war problems are receiving attention today. Chairman Cannon of the House Appropriations Committee has blasted both the sales tax idea and suggestions that military expenditures could be reduced to avoid raising more taxes. In the Senate, a bipartisan group of 11 senators have banded together in an effort to make any post-war resolution more concrete and expressive of this country's peacetime policy. Their suggestion that a United Nations organization be set up with powers to keep the peace by force is expected to meet with strong opposition.
The Allied world is waiting for good news from the Red Army driving on Kiev. For a discussion of the problems facing both sides, here is Columbia's military analyst, Major George Fielding Elliott.
This morning, Bill Downs, CBS correspondent in Moscow, told us that the fight for Kiev was one of the big mystery battles of the war. He said that it was obvious that tremendous fighting was going on, but no one seemed to know exactly where or how the battle was going. Very likely, the explanation lies in the nature of river line fighting. The attacker of a river line, first of all, pushes small detachments of troops across and establishes what is called a bridgehead on the farther bank. Then he tries to enlarge this bridgehead so that the places where he is crossing, whether by permanent bridges or pontoon bridges or fords or assault boats or a combination of these means, are out of range of enemy machine gun fire. When he's done this, he can bring over more troops and some heavy equipment, and then he tries to enlarge his bridgehead still further so that the crossings are out of range of the enemy's artillery. The final stage is when the bridgehead is wide enough and deep enough to allow for the deployment and maneuver of large forces. Then, and not till then, the attacker may say that he has effected a successful passage of the river. The defender of a river line does not ride the whole bank of the river with his troops and try to prevent a single attacking soldier from setting foot on his side. He covers the likely crossing places with outpost forces, and he holds the bulk of his troops back until he can see how and where and in what force the attacker is proposing to cross. Then, at an appropriate moment, the defender launches a counterattack, the purpose of which is to wipe out part of the attacking forces which have already crossed the river, while they are still beyond the reach of help or reinforcement from their comrades, which have not yet crossed. In practice, a river crossing, of course, is a combination of all of these things, and there are a lot of small counterattacks by local forces that, in preparation for the decisive counterattack, which comes when it is finally decided to throw in the main bulk of the defending reserves. Now it seems that the Germans are launching their main counterattack. That this stage has been reached in the Kiev fighting, and the results are not yet known, and may not be known for some days. Meanwhile, south of the great bend of the Dnieper, the fight for Melitopol and the Crimea Railway still goes on, with the Germans fighting hard and the Russians not yet claiming full possession of the city.
That was Major George Fielding Elliott. Moscow today is waiting the momentary arrival of Secretary of State Hull to participate in the Anglo-American-Soviet War Conference. The Russian capital is now having its brightest season, social and otherwise. The ballet, opera, concerts, plays and movies are all going, and foreign diplomats are giving parties in greater style than at any time since the invasion by Germany. During the past week, there have been three brilliant diplomatic receptions in Moscow. A week ago, the Chinese embassy celebrated China's national holiday, and then on Thursday, Donald Nelson was entertained. And last night, the Afghan embassy honored the birthday of the King of Afghanistan. Incidentally, Donald Nelson has presented Premier Stalin with several of his favorite makes of pipes, including one which is said to be about as big as possible and still usable. The war production chief, himself a pipe smoker, also gave the Russian leader some of his own favorite tobacco. Stalin told Nelson he would certainly make use of the gifts. In the Balkans, the Yugoslav Partisan Radio reports that its guerrillas have destroyed an important Krupp industrial plant at Zenica, 30 miles northwest of Sarajevo. More important than this latest military development is the revelation that General Mihailovich, the Yugoslav war minister, has agreed to lead his army's operations against German forces. Mihailovich has also agreed not to fight against the rival guerrilla organization, the Partisans, commanded by General Tito. There's been a decrease in air activity in Western Europe during the past few days, but new photos show great damage inflicted on the German Schweinfurt plants by the recent American bomber attack. For news from Britain, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS London, Larry Lesser reporting.
The main news topic in England today is Anglo-American relations. Some observers over on this side attribute the troubles between the two countries to the normal feelings of irritation arising out of war conditions, to the strained political situation in America, and to the lack of any decisive action on the Anglo-American war front. The other major interest in London lies in the results of the air war. The major question here is, what has been the effect so far of the day and night bombing offensive against Germany? It's difficult to weigh the effects of this slow air war of attrition. But experts here now feel that enough is known of the devastation caused by the Allied air attacks in the past 6 months to justify the bombing policy on which so many of our Anglo-American hopes are placed. Estimates of the damage done to Germany's war potential by those in possession of reconnaissance photographs and information from Europe's underground have reached the not unimpressive total of 30%. That is, 30% of German war industry knocked out and being kept neutralized by constant air attack. In one specialized field, the results are even better. German production of single-seat fighters has been cut in half, mainly by Flying Fortress daylight raids. The cumulative effect of this is expected to influence the course of the war decisively in the next few months. British observers are also quick to point out that the number of German men who have been forced to man the anti-aircraft defenses and to repair the bomb damage has reached impressive totals. One well-informed expert figures that more than 500,000 men are known to be engaged in clearing and repairing air raid damage in Germany, while the whole machinery of civil defense, including fighter crews in the air and on the ground, anti-aircraft gunners, air raid wardens, and firefighters, reaches nothing short of 2 million persons occupied entirely with Anglo-American bombing offensive. But as it becomes obvious that the European war is moving towards its climax, service officials here are emphasizing an important point, that the air bombardment of Germany is an essential preliminary part of the invasion itself, and not, as many have come to believe, an end in itself. A London newspaper, the Sunday Chronicle, has posed a provocative question to its readers this week. The question was, if a new weapon were invented which could kill every man, woman, and child in Germany merely by pressing a button, would you press the button? The majority of British middle-class people answered no, because they feel they'd be murdering millions of people who never wanted this war. I return you now to Doug Edwards in New York.
The Algiers radio this morning reports that street fighting has broken out in Marseille, the great French Mediterranean port city. French patriots are said to have attacked the militia of the Vichy government, and then patrols were put on the streets with armed guards assuming control of traffic. Spain hears that the Vichy government is giving wholehearted cooperation to the Germans in rounding up Italians in France. They're wanted for slave labor inside Germany. It's estimated that 1.5 million Italians now live in France. Many of them are long-time residents. Advices reaching Madrid say that in many cases, particularly in southern France, Italian families have been ejected from farms they have worked for generations. Now for a report on developments in Europe as they reach Spain, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Madrid. Glenn Stadler reporting.
Last week was full of big political and military surprises. As seen from Madrid, this week promises to be just as important. Two historical cities, Rome and Moscow, are focal points of world interest. Indications are the Germans are already beginning to evacuate Rome, but much anxiety is felt over its fate. Will they leave it intact? Foreign observers here believe Pope Pius expressed his position very firmly when he received the German ambassador yesterday. It appears to be quite clear that any action resembling that inflicted upon Naples would be absolutely intolerable. Because of the uncertainty hanging over the Eternal City, the Catholic weekly Ecclesia urges even more intense prayers for the safety of the Holy Father. Warns that if the present situation were permitted to continue, the result would be slow strangulation of the Vatican. Spanish correspondent wrote from Rome, writes that the city is dead, but only in its physical aspect. Everyone is waiting for what they term a new hour of resurrection. Perhaps only a few hours hence, for the 5th and 8th armies are not very far away. A local commentator who has access to high German sources here says that after evacuation of the north, the Nazis won't consider Rome as an open city if such allied units as the Mediterranean Committee are established there. The Germans contend they're respecting the present open city character of Rome. I was in Paris in June 1940 and recall that Hitler demanded that every French soldier leave before he considered it open. Today, there's a picture in a Madrid newspaper showing fully armed German soldiers on guard outside St. Peter's Cathedral, while Nazi planes fly overhead. The meeting of foreign ministers in Moscow commands an especial interest here. The outcome is expected to give an idea of the pattern of future cooperation among the United Nations and its effect on other nations. Reports from Portugal today say that the general feeling of satisfaction over leasing Anzac bases to England has been partially counterbalanced by Germany's strong note of protest. The Portuguese, however, are staging large-scale military maneuvers and seem to be prepared for any eventuality. This is Glenn Stadler in Madrid, returning you to Doug Edwards in New York.
Back in Hawaii, after 114 days spent among natives in the Southwest Pacific, is an American flyer who has quite a story to tell. For that story, Admiral Radio takes you to CBS Honolulu, Webley Edwards reporting.
Harbor on New Britain Island. Today, after spending more than 100 days in the jungle, he's here with me at Hickam Field, close by Pearl Harbor in Hawaii. Captain Post, I guess your parents back in Milwaukee will be pretty happy to hear your voice after having you reported as missing.
Yes, I guess so. And I want to send them my love right now. After being shot down and living the 3 months in the jungle, I'm still in the best of health. I hope when my brothers Lawrence and Paul get into it, they have the same luck I had.
Tell us all about it, Captain.
Well, I was on a reconnaissance flight over a ball when a flight of Jap Zeros jumped me. Photo ships aren't armed, depending entirely upon their speed for safety. They shot out one engine, but I was still evading them and was making for home when another flight of Zeros got the other engine. I still had hopes of crash landing when one Jap who had made a frontal pass set my plane on fire and I had to bail out.
What about your clipping that plane?
Oh, yes. I headed straight for this fellow, hoping to scare him out of the way. And at the last minute, clipped the wing of the plane that shot me down. I knew the Japs would machine gun me if I opened the chute too soon. So I fell free for about 10,000 feet before pulling the ripcord. I hurt my leg on the last few feet of fall in the jungle, was dazed and burned about the hands and face. However, I dusted sulfanilamide on the burns and they healed up fine.
You knew you were in Jap country?
Definitely. I cut up my chute for shelter, made a splint for my leg, and decided I'd have to make for the bush and hide out until I was in better shape. I could drink from some muddy pools by using chlorine capsules to purify the water. I had some emergency rations in my jungle pack. However, it was in the rainy season and rained practically all the time. After a little while, I started traveling. Traveled for 5 days. By moving, I could forget the hunger and pain. And at night, when I could sleep, I dreamed of home and happy times. The fifth day, I stumbled upon a native village. Found some women and children who saw me first. We ran away and called the men, who appeared and very solemnly greeted me by offering to shake hands. My first words were, "Water and kai kai," which means water and food. And they brought me everything they had.
Did they offer you protection?
Well, they were timid at first, as I was the first white man who'd ever been in their village. But one or two of them had seen civilization before, and I was able to tell them that I was a friend and not a Jap. The Japs have treated them so badly that they were glad to help me. And they would ask me, "When are good times coming, master? When is a white master coming back?" In my jungle pack, I had some trade tobacco, fish hooks, and razor blades, which I gave them in payment for food and services. I used what medicine I had to help some of their own sick and injured, for which they were very grateful. I was with them and other friendly natives hiding out for the 3 months, avoiding Jap patrols. Finally reached the coast and eventually was picked up by a Navy rescue party, which landed me in Pearl Harbor about 114 days after I was shot down.
Captain Post is not on leave, but is returning to his reconnaissance squadron, of which, incidentally, he was commanding officer, for more active duty. Good luck to you, Captain Arthur L. Post, wherever you go. This is Webley Edwards in Honolulu. I return you now to New York.
Once again, here's Warren Sweeney with a word from Admiral Radio.
You've heard the expression, "It's not the heat, it's the humidity." In speaking of electronic instruments like those Admiral is now building, you might say, it's not only the heat, it's the humidity. For moisture in the air, as well as extreme ranges of temperature, is a deadly enemy of such equipment. The ordinary radio that operates perfectly in your home would falter or fail entirely in the heavy, humid atmosphere of the tropics. Radios being used by our fighting men must operate perfectly in all climates. For that reason, the Admiral-built instruments going to our armed forces have been conditioned to withstand extreme humidity. The delicate coils of copper wire going into Admiral equipment, for example, are placed in a tank and subjected to a powerful vacuum that draws out every trace of moisture. Then, into this airtight chamber, there flows a stream of liquid wax to seal hidden openings and give permanent protection against the deteriorating effects of moisture. Admiral-built instruments are today in use on many of our fighting fronts, in all climates, under all conditions. But wherever they're found, the pre-tested, rugged dependability of these electronic weapons is helping to bring closer the day of victory. This year, your community chest is a war chest, and to its usual peacetime duties are added a host of wartime responsibilities, aiding prisoners of war, caring for the people of the occupied countries, adults and little children, establishing USO and Seamen's Service Centers for our boys overseas. 17 national relief and service organizations, along with thousands of local relief and welfare groups, have combined in the National War Fund Drive to raise the $125 million needed for the coming year. This is the only appeal that will be made. Give generously when the call comes in your community. World News Today is brought to you each Sunday at this hour by Continental Radio and Television Corporation, makers of Admiral Radio, America's smart set. Be sure to listen again next Sunday when Admiral brings you World News Today by shortwave, direct from leading news centers of the world. Warren Sweeney speaking. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
This is the WBBM Air Theater, Wrigley Building, Chicago.